This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 31 for June 23rd, 2011. I'm your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live on Ustream from the Average Guy Studios here in sunny Bellevue, Nebraska, and posted each week with awesome show notes by Andrew at theaverageguy.tv. You can contact the show, podcast at averageguy.tv. Follow me on Twitter and show announcements at Jay Collison. Or you can find us on Facebook, and then we update all the shows when we post them. Just search The Average Guy Network. All right, well, we've got one regular back tonight and a couple guests. And so I'll first introduce Andrew Morris. And Andrew, how are you doing this evening?
Very well, thanks, Jim. It's a cracking day down here in Melbourne, and sun's out. And about the only thing missing is I can't hear any birds singing, so that's a ripper.
Can't complain. Are you getting any more power out of your solar cells that are on your garage port or on your roof?
We will today.
Okay.
Because yeah, it'll be a nice day, so we should see today we should see probably 3.5 kilowatt hours maybe, which is pretty good for winter.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah, well, hopefully as winter turns to summer, you'll get at least half your power, right? Is that the goal?
That's what we're hoping for, yeah. It's all about offset.
That'd be great. I got to get some solar panels on my roof. Speaking of solar panels from the land where energy runs abundantly and is almost free, and from the homeservershow.com, we've got John Zadler. John, how are you doing tonight?
Hello, gentlemen. Yeah, doing good. We got lots of power. We got that big James Bay thing going for us. So, and we supply lots of current down to the United States eastern seaboard. So
yeah, some of that got it all. Run the lights of New York City, right?
Yeah, well, who knows? enough electricity.
There you go. And then
we power that globe there. You know, on New Year's there, what do you call that? The one that comes down there. You got a name for that? No.
The ball. The new. I don't know. Crystal ball. I don't know.
The ball. The big light ball there.
The one that comes down and
the big old Times thing. Square. Yeah, Times Square and stuff. I thought I had a name.
Everybody goes to bed. I should know it, but I don't. Sorry.
No.
And then joining us as a guest tonight, another Home Server Show guy, but busy with life and doesn't make it to the Home Server Show anymore, but comes out to see us, Chris Lux. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing just fine. I don't have anything exciting like electricity or solar panels to talk about, but happy to be here.
Yeah, St. Louis is treating you okay so far?
Yeah, we got great weather down here right now. We're through some of the crazy storms and tornadoes that Missouri's been having, and it's been a little calmer. So,
does the Missouri River come through St. Louis to the Mississippi, or does that go farther south?
No, that's where they meet. Is in
okay.
St. Louis.
Because we're sending a crap load of water your way. I just want
all
you to
right.
know that
we're yeah. ready. We're ready for it. We blew up our levees last month, so we're ready for
great.
It. Now,
yes, so. Great. We're at feet, several feet above flood stage here in Omaha, and a lot of the fields, you know, a lot of the fields north and south of the city are flooded 3 and 4 miles wide from the river. So
put your computer up on the desk.
Yeah. Well, here in Bellevue, I'm up a couple hundred feet, so I'm fine here. But certainly where I work at Gallup, we're right on the river, and they started bringing in, rock we sandbagged first, and then.
Wow.
Starting Tuesday, they started bringing in reinforcements with rock and crushed gravel to build up that that levee even more. And you know, I think we're going to get – it could probably go up as much as another foot.
Wow.
So we got a lot of water. I just feel bad for the folks downstream because it just keeps coming. So Kansas City, then St. Louis, and ultimately through New Orleans, you guys are going to have a crap load of water on your hands this summer.
That was a phenomenal amount of water that – I saw in some of those photos that you sent through, Jim.
Yeah, about
the video. Wow.
160,000 at Galvin's Point Dam, which is the last dam on the Missouri before Omaha. 160,000 cubic feet per second. So think of a cubic foot as a basketball. So 160,000 of those every second coming out of that dam and making its way downstream.
That's very similar to the floods we had in Queensland earlier this
year. Yeah, and I think, Andrew, you've looked at some of the pictures. Some of the flooding that we're having, I think, probably is very similar.
Similar scale.
Interstate 29 between Council Bluffs and Sioux City is closed in about 6 spots, and both north and southbound covered in about a foot or two of water. So it may be – and they're not going to slow that water down anytime soon. So it could be flooded all summer long. And the problem is all the rainwater and all the snow that we got in the spring, they got record snow up in the mountains, is all coming down at one time, and the dams are full. So they got to let that water out or risk, you know, it flowing over the top. So it's pretty devastating, and we've had a lot of flooding, but we're safe here at the Average Guy Studio. So, guys, thanks for for coming out and talking tonight. I want to spend a little time. We got a kind of a storage or an online storage show tonight. But before we get started, I want to highlight one of the guys that follows us here, Brian Burgess. He's been posting over at informationweek.com, and he put an article about five reasons why to upgrade to Firefox 5. Now, I don't know about you guys. I'm a Chrome guy. And I try to avoid Internet Explorer if I can in most cases, although I have to use it to get to my work email to get the best functioning, you know, Outlook web access. But when I can, I'm on Chrome. Chris, what's your browser of choice?
So I'm a Chrome guy in general, although IE9 is really starting to look attractive to me. I've got that installed, and the main thing that's neat about it is being able to pin websites to your taskbar sort of as independent applications. Which doesn't sound all that useful until you look down at your taskbar and you see like a button for something you use all the time, and it launches it, and it doesn't activate an instance of Explorer on your taskbar. It just uses that little spot as a program, which is probably not that important process-wise, but it's interesting from a usability standpoint. So I'm starting to play with IE9 again.
All right, so you're coming back to the dark side.
Yeah, a bit, yeah.
And have you tried Firefox or Firefox 5?
I haven't touched Firefox for a very long time.
Yeah. You know, and my wife is a Firefox fanatic, which I didn't really know until all the icons for IE started disappearing from the computers at our house. And I was like, hey, where'd your IE icon go? And she's like, oh, no, I took that off. You can't use it.
Wow.
What do you mean I can't use it? She's like, no, I hate Explorer. You have to use Firefox. And so I loaded Chrome and started using that. Andrew, what's your choice?
Yeah, I use Chrome predominantly. Mm-hmm. I have upgraded to Firefox 5, but I'm not really using it.
Okay, Chris, I should have asked you, have you seen a speed, all the speed promises come true in IE9?
I'm not using it enough to compare it at this point. The main reason I use it is to log into the hospital with a Citrix client. Which is much, much more stable in IE than anywhere else.
Yeah.
But I may migrate back there a little bit. I've just got too many links and things in Chrome at this point to comfortably do that.
Yeah, I think for some of our corporate folks who, you know, access VPN, especially, you know, an Enfuse or a Citrix kind of client, IE is still going to be your best supported browser for those for those applications. And I know anything, if you're using anything Microsoft related, that's the best way to get the interoperability. We're going to talk about SkyDrive here in a little bit, so we'll come back to it then. But John, what's your browser of choice?
Yeah, I'm using IE9.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I stick with that, and my son is using Firefox version 4.something. So it's just today I bought him a Mac. So I don't know, he's kind of on the other side. It's almost going to be a father-son war there. I don't know what's going on. You know, it's like Microsoft, and he's using Apple. Well, as a matter of fact, he's actually doing a dual boot there, so he's okay. He's installing Windows 7 on there. So Mac, and then I guess I don't think he'll be using Safari.
Safari, you still there, John?
That use Windows. People who have a Windows machine, if they use Safari,
right. And you know, as soon as you said Safari, you cut out for a second, and so maybe the Microsoft was listening, and they just kind of cut you off.
Yeah. Screening, yeah.
Microsoft Skype, yeah.
They own Skype now. That's right.
So, what did you get? What'd you get them from a Mac perspective?
He wanted a MacBook Pro. It was a toss-up between that one and because they were both priced the same thing. That and the thin one is called what? The Air. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he decided to go for the MacBook Pro because it was a hard drive instead of imagine like he wanted a higher capacity hard drive instead of a really speedy SSD card and drive, and then he wanted it has the built-in DVD drive. So, and it's a little heavier, but you know, that's okay because he's using it for college. So, I figure he would want the lighter one to carry around. But then I think the lighter one was the same price, but I think it was the 11 inch Mac. Yeah. So, here he got the 13 inch Pro. So, you get a bigger screen at the same time. So, he's playing around with that. But I told him to install because I have the MediaSmart server, right? So, with the MediaSmart, they have the Windows Home Server connector software. Like, they have remember, like Microsoft, even for 2011, they're trying to get that you can back up a Mac machine. So since I have the MediaSmart, they have that Mac
connector
in there. So that was one of the first things I told him to put on his computer. Let's see if that Mac connector is going to work.
Did it?
Yeah, he decided to start the dual boot first. Okay. So once he gets a dual boot, then we'll see. And then the other thing is what's cool is because you know, we have what's his name there, the TechNet subscription. I actually downloaded what is it, Mac for Office for Mac 2011.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I got a copy of that. So that kind of saved me you know, a good however much that cost. That must be at least $100 for that software.
Sure.
One of the nice things, you know, my organization has a software assurance agreement with Microsoft. So we can get Office versions for $20 through them. You can get one copy per employee, including the Mac software. So if you're listening and you're wanting, you know, Office or even Office for the Mac, check where you work. If they've got software assurance for their Microsoft licenses, chances are you can participate in a program to get those, you know, those licensed copies of those products for as little as $20. It's a pretty good deal.
For sure. For sure. And I know because he's a student, he got an extra $100 off. I know, Chris, there, I think a couple of years ago, you were saying that you were able to get, what was it, Windows 7 for like $40 or something like that because it's through a university or a school or something?
$10.
$10. Wow. Yeah.
Was that a student discount on the hardware or the operating system?
On the operating system.
Okay.
So you can go in and get a disc for it for $10, and you could get like two copies of the 32 and two copies of the 64. So
sweet.
Yeah.
So down here at the moment, you get a student discount on the Mac hardware as well. So you buy a MacBook and you get a 32 gig iPod Touch in the deal.
Yep.
Well, now, I think a lot of places
going on
still,
here in the U.S. too.
A lot of places are still running the deal where if you get a PC for a certain level, I think it might be from Microsoft's site, that they'll throw in a free Xbox 360.
Oh yeah,
That's been the big thing. Is they're like, you know, well, they're giving you $100 of iTunes credit, or you could get, you know, an Xbox 360. Not a hard choice.
Yeah. That's
well,
for
that's
sure.
It. See, my son got the $100 off the PC right away off the MacBook Pro 13 inch. I got a $100 card for iTunes, so anything from the iTunes store. And I guess later on I can purchase if I want that, what is it, the Lion, right, for like $40. I can get that through the store. And I got a HP printer out of that, like a $100 HP printer. And then you go online. It's a something 4200, something like that. It's a fax and the scanner and all of that. So it's a $100 printer. Well, you paid $100, but then you go online and you put in your, you know, that you bought so and so at the store, and then they send you a credit, a check. So it adds up there when you know the right people or the right specials.
Nice.
Nice. Everyone loves a discount.
Yeah, so we've identified a couple places for discounts, right? Certainly, if you're in school or you've got a student, make sure they're checking in at the school bookstore. Right, Chris? That's where you got your...
Yeah, so always check the school bookstore because Microsoft's strategy is to get their products in as many students' hands as possible because they'll eventually be buying them for their companies, or they'll move to a company and say, hey, I demand to use this Microsoft product or this Windows PC because that's what they've had in the past. So there's really, really good deals for Microsoft software at most college campuses.
Yeah. Watch for deals, especially I think back to school is going to be a big bonanza this year of package deals that are coming out, whether that be a Touch or an iPad or a free Xbox or whatever. I think that we're going to see a lot of those. And then we talk about this all the time on the Home Server Show, but you know, a $200 TechNet Plus subscription gets you all that software for testing. It got to be in your kind of stay in your home environment, but you do get access. If you're messing around with a lot of Microsoft software, it does give you the ability to download just about anything you want in your home space. So a couple ways of making it. God, don't pay retail. Never pay retail. For Microsoft product, you know, at the very least, you know, I needed some copies of the OS when Windows 7 first came out, and I bought that 3-pack for, you know, $150, and that brought that down to $50 in OS, and, you know, that's a way to do it if you've got multiple PCs. So there's better ways to do it. Come back full circle, Firefox. Let me read through these real quick, and you guys can kind of chime in if you want. We talked about the new improvements to Firefox 5, why you would want to necessarily upgrade. I'll include the link to Brian's article in the show notes. But he says it's added support for CSS animations, and I don't even track any of that stuff in the browser, to be honest with you. It says here extra support for CSS makes it possible to animate transitions from one CSS style configuration to another. Maybe that's more of a developer thing, but I don't I don't watch for that in the browser. So, but yeah. But maybe more developers. Number two, easier to find the do not track button. Now, this one is probably makes a lot of sense if you don't want to have your internet surfing tracked on the browser. Which you know, if you're going to shut that off, we all know why. That button that button is now easier to find.
That's just incognito mode or whatever on the other browsers. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Firefox 5, the latest version is more stable, which is always good. I know Firefox has always been a fairly stable browser, but it looks like here in 5 it gets more stable, more support for or better support for Android devices. So as things are rolling out, especially on Android, some opportunity for some more Android support. And then, of course, like we hope on everything, improved performance. And so we're always hoping, right, upgrades bring improved performance. But just ask the friends at Microsoft who made Vista if the next OS always is improved performance. So, Brian, thanks for throwing that article out there. If folks want to reference that, they can come out and take a peek on the site, and we'll have the link. I want to talk a little bit about SkyDrive, guys. I got an email, just this week saying from Microsoft saying SkyDrive had been improved. And upgraded some. They have done some things to use some of the features with HTML5, and Chris, you and I have talked a lot about SkyDrive over the years and some of the good things about it and some of the new things about it. What was your initial impression as you saw SkyDrive for the first time with the changes?
The new changes, yeah. It strikes me that they're moving SkyDrive to mimic what we now know is going to be the Windows 8 motif. It's the same type of thing as the Metro UI that we're seeing on Windows Phone. It's very similar to where Media Center used to look, but kind of an updated view on that. It uses a lot more live tiles. So I actually have it pulled up right now, and my photo collection is much more dynamic. It shows the folders that I have photos in, and they're just cycling through in a really nice, smooth way. I think it looks great. Right now, it's still a little limited. I just have a photos and a documents folder on the side. But what's there looks fantastic. Still some issues with the navigability. You know, I'm looking at some of my folders are not where I put them initially. There's things that are kind of garbled a little bit. Okay. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just drag those over. You can't really do that. You kind of have to go into a file and find this weird move command and try to move it over. And why it doesn't work just like a folder drag and drop thing is a little beyond me, especially since Microsoft has never provided an official route for mounting SkyDrive as a folder on your computer.
Yeah.
So that you can go in there and manipulate files that way. So awesome some issues.
I'll be honest with you, Chris. I would have preferred they provided that mount point and not changed anything on the user, you know, the user interface for the web.
Yeah.
And made it accessible through your Windows Explorer. And that would have been a lot more handy. No changes to the storage limits. So it's still 25, 5 and 25, right?
Which is more than anybody else is really offering right now. But you can't purchase any more yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and some folks have said Microsoft's really, they offer this, but they don't encourage it, right? They don't. I know that sounds kind of weird, but
yeah,
but, you know, that's there. They can say they have it, but one of the reasons they haven't offered integration. And now, Office has some. I think Office has some integration in it. When you're in Word, you can save or OneNote, you can save your files directly to the web. So there's some integration that way, but not in the way we would think of it from a Windows Explorer standpoint. Andrew, are you using SkyDrive at all? Is that something that you found useful?
I haven't looked at SkyDrive. I'm typically a Dropbox user for online storage. And for photos in the past, I've used SmugMug and Flickr. But SkyDrive, 25 gig for free is pretty appealing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, Chris, from a photo standpoint, I mean, you're a photo guy. So does the front end for the photos change enough for you to want to use this more, or is it still too cumbersome?
So it's really close. You know, it'd be very nice to be able to have a single location online to store all of my pictures. I'm a Flickr user, and that's really, they don't encourage you to put all of your pictures up. They want you to kind of pick your best pictures and put them up for discussion. Pictures are hard for cloud services because they're unique. You know, Apple's been talking about using their music service where they can basically group one song and have one copy of that song for everyone, and not have everyone load their entire database up. And that's really smart from their standpoint. Pictures are a challenge because they're all unique. And once you've got into the digital SLR realm, you're talking anywhere from 5 to 12 megabytes per picture. And then you can get even bigger than that if you're going with raw images. So they can really take up a lot of space. I know my collection is well over 25 gigabytes at this point, and I would need something a little bigger. That being said, if I thought that they would let me purchase some extra space and I could fit my whole photo collection on there, I'd be putting it up there tonight.
Really?
Yeah.
That committed to it, huh?
It interfaces great with the Windows Phone that I've been playing with the last few months.
Yeah, it would.
It does a nice job to tag into blogs. You can tie your WordPress photos in there, so you can log into those pretty easy. It's a very easy interface for sharing. I feel like it would be a good place to fit how I use my data.
It also connects in with the Live package, right? Windows Live Photo Gallery.
Yeah.
I think you can save to a SkyDrive, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a nice, and that's a really nice photo application if you have nothing.
Right.
We did some features on that back when we first started the show back in the winter.
Actually, even if you have other things, I've given up Picasa for that because it does so much for me.
Yeah, the facial recognition in that's pretty good. And
it
grouping software or grouping pictures together by individual.
Right. And the one thing that they advertise for it is the whole like take 25 pictures and then get the best shot of each person. That works terribly.
Oh, really?
I try that. And like people have extra shoulders and extra fingers, and it doesn't work as well as you'd expect.
That was part of the whole To the Cloud
campaign
back in the winter. Mm-hmm. Now, they do say here, that they did make it faster interface.
For sure.
And with Internet Explorer 9, you can now pin SkyDrive to your Windows 7 taskbar. You're just one click away from saving, sharing, and collaborating on documents. So, that sounds like, for simplicity's sake, a pretty easy solution. It's just difficult to get to. For me, like you said earlier.
I wonder if they're going to improve any type of a connection when they come out with Windows 8. Because I know that one of the things when they were talking about Windows 8 is they were saying like a lot of HTML5 code, right? They were saying a lot of that. Like instead of, because I think the Windows phone bases their images or their however they make their pages, they use something
right.
else. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think they were using Silverlight, whereas these guys now with Windows 8, they're supposed to be using more of the HTML code. So, I wonder how this is, if they're going to bring, more life to. Because when I see SkyDrive, I see they get like a bit like little incremental. Like they're still around, they get a couple little changes, but it's not like something nice, big, and great, Just a couple little something that's there and gets little upgrades.
The thing I like about it is it works almost the same in Chrome as it does in IE. So that to me says that it's become more HTML compliant.
Hmm. Right.
And the thing I especially like is the inbuilt Office functionality. So if you create a Word document or an Excel document, it actually looks and feels like Excel or Word.
Yeah, all available online. When we first started the show, I was trying to use the integrated Office documents for sharing so that we could do show notes across hosts. And it wasn't as intuitive and didn't work as well as Google Docs. And so we moved over to Google Docs for our show notes. And for that application, it's just worked better, at least for me.
Yeah, and I think that's where Google have got the niche, isn't it? Well, it'd be interesting to see how well the new version would do it.
Chris, you're on notes tonight, right? I mean, you use it only, I think the last time we talked, you say you only use it when you're on the show.
I've gone back and forth. So I recently was trying to put together an Excel spreadsheet for It's kind of random, but for potential trees to plant out at my parents' place at some point.
Okay.
And so I was trying to make an Excel spreadsheet of those of the that information, and I tried it in the Microsoft Excel web app, and it was pretty darn good.
Okay.
You know, I was able to make everything I wanted. It was able to do a lot of features through the ribbon UI that you're used to from Word. And the neat thing is if I go into Word on my computer, since I'm logged in with Windows Live, it shows me those as things I've recently edited. So I can open them right there on the desktop. And of course, I say that, and now I'm on there right now trying to open that Excel file, and it's not working.
Of course.
So, you know, I think it's a neat alternative. I think eventually when they can get the majority of the native Office application functions in there, that'll be the way to go. But Google's got a big first step, a big head start. And I think it'll take a little bit of coaxing to get people to move over.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I'd like to try is not putting Office on a PC and seeing if I could survive on just the Office web apps.
If you're connected all the time, maybe.
Yeah, and make a go of that. And I'm connected 95% of the time I'm on a PC. I mean, I'm either at work or I'm at home.
Right.
I don't travel enough to make that, you know, to make that a problem. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see. Andrew, you were going to say something?
Yeah, the sort of the Chromebook methodology.
Yeah, exactly.
Be heading with that one, exactly. Your web OS or your Splash Top or something like that.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, to Microsoft's credit, I think the web apps are really good from an individual standpoint. I don't know how well the collaboration works, and I haven't tried it as of late, so maybe it's gotten better. But to use Word or use Excel or in OneNote online is dynamite. I mean, client is still better, to be honest with you. But OneNote online is really good.
Would you use OneNote over Evernote? Have you ever?
Yes.
I've not played with OneNote yet, and I think I need to.
Yeah, I have. In fact, I started with Evernote for show notes, and then I moved to OneNote for a while, and I was sharing those. And I was trying to share them with John and Dave, you know, on the show, and they didn't want to look at them. And so eventually when I started my own podcast, I thought, well, I'm going to try this OneNote thing. And then I thought, well, I'll give Google Docs a try. And from a collaboration standpoint, I just think Google Docs works. It's the easiest and it works the best right now.
Sure.
And it's the most intuitive for collaboration. So that's just, you know, there is some merit, though, to the live, you know, to the Windows Live integration pieces with this and a live account and your mail. I mean, it is all right there. And so that may be a very viable solution for some folks. And not have to ever own Office.
Yeah, if you're someone who's a heavy OneNote user too, I think it's a really nice thing to be able to be working in your OneNote notebook in your work environment. And then if you're at home, you don't have to fire up the laptop to be able to keep working or update something or whatever.
Yeah. Well, definitely needs a sync option. Well, that will sync, give you some offline functionality.
It does now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It does. Okay.
It does.
Yeah. They're
integrating with Live Mesh as well.
Okay.
So.
Mm.
Good. Yeah. Well, it sounds like there's some things coming. Microsoft is certainly moving in that direction. I still don't think they move fast enough in a lot of, you know, to I think John's point earlier. It would be nice if they iterated just a little bit faster than they do today.
Yeah. It's interesting on the OneNote topic, we've been talking about it a bit at work lately. I'm just looking now, it looks like they've just released OneNote for the iPhone, but we're moving towards being an Android shop out here in Australia, and of course they don't have a OneNote client for Android yet, so it becomes a conundrum. How do you sync it up, or you know, and also will Microsoft support the Google platform?
Right, and it would be nice to see Office on the Android platform. It's big enough now. Why can't it be there?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we've got a ways to go. All right, so speaking of SkyDrive, so we talked SkyDrive, of course, online. There's Chris showing us his Windows 7 phone with Office right on there. Chris, let's talk about that for a second. How are you liking your Windows phone?
Great. You know, I when I got it, I had my my iPhone sitting right next to my bed. I thought, you know, I got to have it there in case I need to use some of the features that I've gotten addicted to over the last couple of years. It hasn't been turned on in the 3 weeks I've had this phone.
Wow.
it's great. You know, there's little things that are taking some getting used to. There's like any phone, there's just the way you handle it is a little bit different. But I'm finding lots of great apps. I'm finding the things that I need are all right where I want them. I'm able to get in and out of stuff faster, which is what they advertise. You're supposed to be able to do is do stuff quick. And, I love it, frankly. So
cool.
And yeah, so I think it may not be for everyone yet. I think the Mango update is going to address 99% of the things that I noticed right away where I'm like, wow, that's kind of odd or that's kind of different from the way I'd expect it to work. And those are things they've already announced as, yes, that's going to be fixed in the next couple months. So I'm very much looking forward to that update. But even as it stands now, this little phone is fantastic.
And certainly from a Windows 7 or a Windows Phone perspective, you kind of buy into the Windows ecosystem when you
hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah. Well,
but the other thing is that it's very Facebook centric. So they really do bring a lot of that to the front. So your contacts are linked into Facebook. Your the pictures for everyone are linked in there. There's sort of these people hub where you can get a lot of info, and most of that is drawn from Facebook. They'd like to say that it's equal with Windows Live, like because you have a profile on Windows Live, but 99% of what I'm drawing down from that is directly from Facebook. So.
All right. Yeah. Well, I was going to wait for that phone, and then it just took too long to come on to Sprint, and I ended up with an Android phone, which I really do like.
Sure.
It's been a great little phone, but awesome. Yeah.
How's the battery life, Chris?
It's good. You know, the thing's got a huge screen. It's got like a 4.3 or 4.5 inch screen, something like that. And it's good. I get easily through the whole day. The other day, I was on call, so I started at 7 a.m. I watched a 45-minute television show off Netflix over the Wi-Fi and was working with it pretty much throughout the day, and it lasted me till about 4 a.m.
Wow. Wow.
So, and I worked through till the next day, so it was dead the rest of the night, but it was useful for the rest of the time. So probably shouldn't have admitted I watched TV at work, but oh well.
Chris, you have SkyDrive access on your phone there natively?
Yes, sort of. Okay. So, everything that I post up to SkyDrive, pictures and document-wise, go directly into Office or into the Pictures Hub. And any picture that I take or document that I create on here gets automatically synced to the phone and to SkyDrive. So they go back and forth.
And that's the beauty of that ecosystem, right, which is that pictures are belong in the Pictures Hub no matter where those pictures are, right?
So correct. Facebook pictures, the things I took, the things that people send me through email, all of those are together in one place. So half the time I don't even know where they came from, which is fine by me.
Yeah, you just want to see the pictures.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So pictures and docs, and is music that way as well?
Yes. So that's actually kind of interesting. So you go into the music and videos hub and, you know, I'm used to it just saying like the last CD you listened to or the last MP3 you listened to. But instead it says, you know, you've recently watched this YouTube clip and your friend posted this video on Facebook and you watched this podcast a couple days ago. Is this what you want to watch again? So it does a really interesting job of putting all of your media into one little grouping.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's great. Sometimes I'm like, well, how the heck did that end up there?
Yeah.
But it really is what you've been using and what you want access to. So.
Well, and the same idea behind libraries in Windows 7, right? It pulls all the documents, music, pictures, podcasts, and videos into the same view, no matter where they're located on your PC.
Exactly.
So yeah, so it's nice that that's consistent. I could see from a media consumer standpoint, it'd just be nice to have it all in one place. You don't really care. My sister doesn't care where that stuff's at. She just wants access to her pictures.
Right.
You know?
Right. So. And yet there's still the granularity where you can go into each individual area and pick out what you want. So.
Okay. Well, we talked a little bit about SkyDrive in that, and so, you know, that certainly is not as popular as Dropbox is right now. It seems like everybody, at least I've talked to as of late, has jumped onto Dropbox. And Andrew, Dropbox has had some issues as of late with their security. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was an article on Wired.com the other day, June 20th, I think it was, where it was identified that Dropbox had unlocked some of their accounts for around about 4 hours from 1:54 Pacific time on Sunday. I guess it's one of those things that unless you knew somebody's Dropbox email address, you'd never try to access it. But they are putting it out there that people should have a look at their Dropbox folder and see if there's anything missing or anything any unusual activity.
Yeah. We've started using Dropbox at, I mentioned this before in the show, at our church to kind of as a group collaborative, you know, hey, I'm done with this video file. I'm going to drop it in here. Can you load it to the PC at the church or can somebody edit this thing or whatever for group collaboration? Mm-hmm. And setting up those security options are very, very easy. John, are you a Dropbox guy at all? Do you use Dropbox for much?
I have a couple of little folders here and there. And what I like sometimes is when you're able to, let's say on the website, you go on the website and you want to link to something, you know? So at least what's cool is that's it. With Dropbox, you can create a link. And so, you know, when you do a post, you can link to your image or whatever in your Dropbox. Right. So I kind of play around with it that way.
And that's in the public. There's a public folder that you can do.
Yeah,
that in,
more right? for. Yeah. So I guess there, I don't really have to worry about any type of security because right. you know basically I'm volunteering all this these images and stuff.
Exactly.
So so I kind of use it for that instead of using different programs. But I think before I used to, you know, I'm not sure if it was Flickr. I used it. You can go to that account and get a URL and then post. I found it a little bit more messy, a little bit more work, and so Dropbox is a little bit easier for that. So that's what I tend to use. It's not a big major thing. So like I said, even with these issues of security, it's not like I got some stuff there that I'm protected about.
Right. Yeah. And when we sold our van, I took 8 or 9 pictures of the van, put them in that public folder on Dropbox, got the URLs, and then put that in Craigslist. And that was just a really easy way to share those. You know, you can SkyDrive has a sharing capability, but like you said, John, sometimes I think it's harder to use. Dropbox makes that pretty easy to get that URL and for folks to access those files. Andrew, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
Yeah, you and I have had the odd photo that we've sent back and forth across Dropbox as well. I think you and Sarah were out to dinner one night, and
right.
you sent me a couple of messages on Skype and then took a photo and threw it into Dropbox, and
we were at Outback,
PC when I was at right? work. That's right.
Yeah. We were at Outback, which is a big Australian, supposedly Australian restaurant, right? It's probably nothing. It's probably an American hack for right? We from my phone, that was a very easy, took the picture, then on the Android phone, hit the share button, and then chose Dropbox, and then chose the folder that you and I share for the podcast. Drop that in there, and bam, it was done. And a couple clicks, and I was done.
Yeah, and likewise, when I was at my parents' place the other day, I took a photo of the valley with the mist in it, and it came across to you that way. So yeah.
And of course, you and I use Dropbox to share. So when I'm done editing, or I'll take the raw file from the podcast, and I'll drop that in Dropbox for you to listen to as you do the show notes. And I don't know what it is, and Chris, maybe you know, but Dropbox just seems faster than other applications that I've tried to use that have, you know, file sharing capabilities in them.
I've never touched it.
Oh, you haven't used Dropbox at all?
Nope.
Okay.
Never used it.
Oh man, you're missing out.
Why not, Chris? Why haven't you used Dropbox?
I suppose I don't tend to need all my files in one place at any given time. For the most part, I take what I want and need with me, whether it's on my phone or my Zune HD or something. And and if I want to have a document I collaborate on, I don't send it back and forth. I throw it up onto either Windows Live or Google Docs. So I think I haven't needed an additional online storage space for sharing because I don't collaborate in that way very much.
Okay. Yeah, and if you do, I think Dropbox is the easiest to use.
I will certainly try it.
For collaboration, that's where I think it does best. You know, I can create a folder, right click on, and you know, there's a little client that you can install on your PC.
Right
click, go permissions, I put in Andrew's email, I send it to him, he accepts it, that folder is then instantly linked.
Right.
And then I just drop those files in there. It works really, really slick. I don't use it much to store personal files that I'm going to get to later. That doesn't seem to work real well for me because I can do that on the home server.
Sure.
But to be able to share those files easy, just Andrew and I have to both, or John and I, or you and I just have to have Dropbox you know, a Dropbox account. So works right. pretty well. But Andrew, certainly they've had some security problems as of late. Do you, after the security, after they leave the doors open for 4 hours last week, you putting any personal information up there?
I don't have a lot of personal information up there now. I use it more for syncing things like my KeePass password file between my work PC and my home PCs.
Okay.
So if I make a change to that, it doesn't matter where I open KeePass from, I've still got that password file as a current version. So that's got its own, I think it's Blowfish encryption or 256-bit encryption anyway.
It's
so
something.
I don't sort of have to worry about that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are other services that provide the same thing, but Dropbox has become such a household name. Per se.
Right. Right.
So it's
except in the Lux family, it's very popular everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I've changed my password on it, but that's about all.
Okay, and if I wanted to, are there other ways? Say I don't, so I'm not trusting Dropbox at this point.
Yeah, so there was an article on Lifehacker about using TrueCrypt to create an encrypted volume that you then sync via Dropbox. Look, my take, and I'll throw that in the show notes. My take is, as soon as you add another application that's on top of your operating system, you've then got to have that on every machine that you want to access that Dropbox with.
Right.
So, you know, if I've got you know, a laptop and a desktop and a PC at my parents' house, it means I've got to then run TrueCrypt on everything to be able to get to that encrypted content.
Well, let's just say for a sec, though, maybe you're throwing a few pictures, a few documents that you're sharing with folks, but you do want to keep some personal information up. Encrypting one or two files shouldn't be that big of a deal,
okay.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I think for the average user using a solution like Dropbox or maybe any other file sharing application of sort, whether that be a SkyDrive or a CrashPlan or voila, whatever, might be a good practice to just encrypt that one file anyway, just in case, there was some talk Dropbox weeks ago of, you know, the employees aren't supposed to be able to see those files, and then it was found out they could. And for a while, employees could get into other people's Dropboxes and view files. If it's that important, just crypt that one file and leave everything else encrypted. I mean, certainly pictures don't need to be encrypted. Unless you're a congressman from New York.
Yeah, that's even made the media out here that. I sort of tend to think that it depends what you're putting in the cloud. If you don't want it to be looked at, then you don't put it up there.
Yeah, but what's the case of if I've got some sensitive information in there, bank account information, social security number, blah, blah, blah. I don't put that in a lot of documents, but if I did want to store it in that place, just encrypt it. I mean, I don't see the harm in getting that done.
Yeah, true. I think also if you're going to go down that path, maybe you can always use the built-in password mechanism in, you know, Word, Excel, something like that.
True.
So you do need a password to open it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think there's some easy encryption type. John, if you were going to encrypt something, if you needed to encrypt a file, is there anything that you would use that would just quickly encrypt it?
Well, the quickest thing I use is when I use an archive the file and then that's it. Then you put a password protection. I don't know how secure that is, but that's a little bit of a quick thing for me because I have when you right click on a file, I have a link there that says to compress the file.
Right.
So right there, compress it. Then then when it does the compression, it says, "Do you want to create a password?" I said yes. So it's just like one or two clicks. Because I don't want to, go through a big mess of, running some kind of, securing your PC that everything is like, what they got that BitLocker and the Windows 7 and all that stuff. It's,
right.
I don't want to get too fancy. Because then, sometimes it gets too hard. Then you crash a hard drive or something like that. And then you just don't know how to get back up,
Chris, you and I have, back in the day, we worked with a little bit of some solutions. We used CrashPlan to share files that we wanted to store, not necessarily access, right? But that we wanted to store. I last night on the Home Server Show, I was talking about Voila has really stepped up their game. They're a lessee company, and they have made their interface better. They do have group sharing, much like Dropbox does, so I can invite you to a group folder as well. And Plus, I get, you know, like on Dropbox, I get 200, I mean, I get 2 gig of free space. You know, on Voila, I just use 2 PCs in the house, and I share some storage space, and I get up, now I'm up to like 150 gig of right. space, which is pretty good, and it's all free. From you know, some time has gone under the bridge now for you. We've been away from talking about that. Is there, besides SkyDrive, is there another one of those online storage solutions that you might be leaning towards at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I use CrashPlan now, and I have my entire home server backed up there. So that's kind of nice to know that there's a cloud solution where everything's stored, and that's a paid service.
Yeah. How much do you pay for that?
I think it's like $4.50 or $5 a month.
Okay, so not much.
Which isn't terrible, and especially knowing that if the place burned to the ground, I'd still have, which I almost did tonight. Never mind.
cooking dinner?
Yeah, I turned on the wrong burner and nearly set things on fire.
But yeah.
That's all fixed now.
Yeah, good.
I think it's nice to know that the data is saved somewhere else and that won't be lost if things go wrong. But I have some things on Flickr. I have some things on SkyDrive. I have a few things on my Picasa account. So I have things stored in other places on the cloud. But none of them have quite gotten to the point yet where I say, hey, I'm putting everything out there. You know, yeah. I'm ready to put all my pictures. I'm ready to put all my music. I'm ready to, you know, to trust the cloud with all this stuff and no longer rely on my PC to do any of that.
Yeah,
it's the leap of faith, isn't it?
Well, and I'm
not ready yet.
I'm still keeping things local. In fact, before the show, I was talking to Andrew. I've got my OS drive is starting to go bad on my Windows Home server, and I need to back that thing up again real quick and make sure if it does go, you know, completely hosed, I've got a complete backup of it. But my storage strategy is still to keep things local, but I am getting to the point, and I use Voila for this because it's just enough space for me. All my pictures, all my music, all my documents are all synced to Voila.
Sure.
And so it's just a third party backup. John, are you using anything online for backup and storage?
Yeah, I'm using Keep Vault.
Okay.
Yeah, they're pretty reliable. So that's a built-in Windows Home Server add-in, and it's a good company and stuff. So, you know, because remember we were even talking on the Home Server show, like some of the other companies that, you know, they folded. You know, this kind of sucks when you got a lot of data up at these guys, and then all of a sudden they close up shop. Then it's like, oh man, you know.
Right.
You know, can I get my stuff off before they close up or you know, or maybe these security issues like Dropbox and stuff like that, all of a sudden you find out your stuff is open up. So, you know, it's like find somebody reliable and somebody that's been there for a while. Just like I haven't heard from those guys CloudBerry there, but
Heard from them in a while, have we? Yeah, I think it still is a little the market's a little immature from a storage standpoint when we talk about cloud storage. So, certainly Amazon has been in that space for a long time. And continues to make their offerings better. But it's still, there's a lot of different options. Chris, I know CrashPlan, I know Voila. John, I know Keep Vault all use fairly good, solid encryption to back up those files when they make their way to the cloud. Obviously, you trust CrashPlan with your data up there, I would assume, sensitive data as well. So, yeah, I think that part's fairly taken care of. You know, this deal with Dropbox, of course. Dropbox, I don't think encrypts those files that are there. I don't know, Andrew. Do you know they're not encrypted in any way? They're
encrypted.
They are. Okay.
Yeah, they run an encryption that comes back to that's bound to your account.
But during that period of openness, nothing, everything was wide open at that point.
Well, yeah, I guess what wide open in so far that you know, if you had to know, you had to know the email address of the person you were trying to access. So
I know your email address, so I could have got to your Dropbox, right?
But if I didn't know that the password service was down, why would I be trying anyway?
Right on.
Yeah. That's why I'm looking at it.
Yeah, yeah. I think I use Dropbox very in a utility standpoint. I'm not putting secure stuff up there. I'm not there, and especially after this, I might give it a little bit of time before I start doing that. But I'm going to use it though to transfer files around. I'm going to put the Home Tech podcast up there for you to grab, right?
Absolutely.
So, have no problems with that. Chris, I saw a post from you on Facebook the other day. You had been out at Ancestry.com and had been working with your family stuff. And we've never talked about that on the show here. But I, because I saw your post, I went out, and I hadn't been out to Ancestry.com in, geez, years now at this point. And I was pretty impressed with the change. Now, it's still a little pricey for me, but talk a little bit about what you're doing out there and how that works.
So, and this does tie in because it's, you know, it's a home technology. It's something you use that's, you know, related to things people do just as part of their daily lives. And this has been sort of a season for family reunions. We had the Luxes are part of a branch of people, the Bowles family tree. So we all get together and meet every 4 years for a big meeting. And one of the guys who would always come to those meetings has been working on a computer-based version of the family tree, and but he would always make these printouts that were kind of awkward, or he would print out like a list of people, and you couldn't really tell what you were looking at. And we realized that you could export his entire database into what's called a GEDCOM file, and then you could upload that up to Ancestry, and it would basically populate your tree. Well, he had put together just under 2,000 family members into this thing, so within a half an hour, we went from having just the two people in the tree to suddenly over 1,000, almost 2,000 people. And Ancestry.com, when you pay for a subscription, which is, I want to say it's like $20 a month or something like that.
Fairly expensive.
Which I'm not going to do long term, but while I'm building the tree initially, what it lets you do is it finds links to public documents. So to other people's trees, it finds links to census reports, to immigration documents, to war service documents, all these things. And so suddenly you find a link to someone else's family tree and you add another branch, and you can add 20, 30 people in an hour just sitting there searching through. And so I've been able to expand out the Lux side with some confidence back about 7 or 8 generations.
Wow.
And it's really exciting. So we've sort of figured out, we're narrowing down the area in Germany and France, sort of the Alsace area where we seem to have come from. And just a really exciting way to bring all of that into one place. So that's pretty fun. And there's one other website that we've been playing with too that we'll bring up in a minute. But what have you been finding, Jim, with yours?
Well, you know, the thing I found very quickly was birth certificates, and like my own birth certificate, there was a link to that. You know, there was the county hospital that I was born in has put all the records online.
Nice.
I think that's getting pretty common, and so I could pull that up. I found my dad's birth certificate. Now, I didn't pay, so I couldn't get access. I mean, I'm kind of trusting that they're there. I didn't actually see them, but there was a link to it, and I clicked on it and said, oh, you need to subscribe.
Right.
And I kind of held off. I'm not ready to – right now I've got some things going on. I'm not ready because once I start doing that, I will totally get sucked into it.
Well, and the neat thing too is you can add other members of your family. So if you know that Uncle Earl and, you know, Cousin Jenny – also like to do Ancestry stuff, you can all link into a shared account.
Yeah.
And you can all be adding on to it. So right now I've got two of us, but we're going to add a third person in this week. And we know of others that are interested. And as we link out to other trees, this thing just keeps growing and growing. And you can add pictures, you can add stories. The story thing is kind of neat, where you can what I'm planning on doing is taking a big thing of photographs and part of the family tree, sitting down with my grandfather, who's 93 years old, and recording comments and stories, and, you know, showing him a picture of somebody and saying, hey, who is this and what does this picture mean to you? And, you know, he always it's that personal side of things where he says, oh, well, yeah, this happened to be at the picnic at so-and-so. And it's like, well, who was that? And it's like, oh, they were the, you know, the mayor of Indianapolis back then, and we were friends with their kids. And, you know, it's like these stories that he never would think to tell you until you're going through pictures. And you can upload that audio straight to the site. So as you go through pictures or clicking on people in the tree, it brings it to life a little more and lets you see some of the personal information. There's still room for improvement. I think that they've really got to work a bit on making it more social. The social aspects of it is a little clunky, but wow, what a neat way to find aspects of your family that you didn't know about.
I did find the interface improved over the old. Now, I haven't done any genealogy work now, probably right. since the early 90s maybe. And I did a bunch of work when I lived out in Monterey. That's kind of where my family originates from, Monterey, California.
Right.
And did some manual work. And then at that time, you know, you could buy genealogy software and they would – you could buy like Census Bureau
right.
CDs, right? And they'd send them to you. You could find stuff. And wasn't connected very well. Like you said, you have to do these printouts and stuff. Chris, can I get access? So, like, if I wanted to see your family tree, do I have to buy the subscription to be able to see your family tree?
No, just to add to it. Okay. So I could invite you as a guest, and you could come view everything you wanted and not edit a thing, and you could look through and see every single detail. And as I add things, you could see them. So we can add the whole family to a guest access and not let Cousin Bobby go in and delete my entire side of the tree because
you made it
in my car or something. So, it's really pretty good at that.
I thought it found more information, you know, now again, I couldn't get to it, but
right.
when I put stuff in, it seemed to find that information very, very quickly and, right. and, you know, links to it. Oh, hey, you're in this document and,
right. You know, well, as an example, Jim, I could, you know, if you said your birth certificate was in there, mm-hmm. When we get a break here in a little bit, I could go in there and search for you, and I can probably pull that birth certificate and let you know if it's a real thing or not, because I can search for anyone's documents. They don't have to be linked to my tree.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be kind of cool to know.
So, so that's a pretty neat thing. So.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. So since we have Andrew from Australia on here, it'd be interesting to see how many Australian documents that they've loaded and have available.
There's a whole chapter in Australia of ancestry.com.au as well. So I don't, and if I go to ancestry.com, it actually takes me to the Australian site. So I don't know if it's the same company or the same backend database.
Sure,
or not.
Sure, it's got to be.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah.
I'll give you my details, Chris, and see if you can find.
certainly, they have ratcheted up. I think they've ratcheted up the offer. I'll be honest with you, Chris. The price is a little prohibitive for me at this point, just to dabble.
Absolutely.
You know, it gets a little pricey at a couple hundred bucks a year for what they're offering. Now, can you get in and get out? So, can you buy a 1 month use it get
you
out?
You can
wait. 4 months till you got some more information, jump back in.
So is your middle name T and your mother's maiden name Woodruff?
Yes, that is me.
All right, so yeah. I found you.
Now you just gave away all my sensitive information. I'll have to.
Uh-oh.
No, I'm just kidding. Well, they always ask your mother's maiden name, right? I'll have to blurb that out. It'll be like blah, 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 blah.
Oh, sorry.
So. Kind of like that under that submarine cable to Australia.
No, the funny thing is that your middle initial is T,
yes.
right? So it has your middle name listed as T, spelled T-E.
Really?
So I don't think that's your middle name, is
no,
it?
No, it's Thomas.
Okay, all right.
Interesting.
So bottom line, there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. It does confirm that you were born in California,
yep.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. No, it's,
can you look up the Australian databases as well?
You know, you can pay for an international account, and I have not done that at the moment.
So it's U.S.
Okay,
only.
Okay, so it's only in the U.S.
Well, for what I've paid for. And,
U.S.
And,
U.S. and Canada or just U.S.?
That's a good question. I think it's just U.S.
John, have you done any genealogy work on your family?
No. My immediate family, let me tell you, they're, like at Christmas time, there's about 45 of us, you know?
Yeah.
So that's big enough. it's like, I don't want to know about everybody else, you know? It's like, yeah. I got my parents and grandparents, and that's about it. You know, there's enough. There's, you know, like I said, just the immediate family is like around 45 when we got a wedding or something like that. So
right.
So that's enough. That's enough to know.
Well, my mom is a part of 9 in her family, so she's
one of 9.
And so the cousins are spread all across the United States, and there's tons of us, and we're, you know, there's a lot. They put together a book back in the manual days when it was some online but mostly manual. They put together a Woodruff family book that literally is – it had to be an inch or two thick. that they mm-hmm. somebody typed all that stuff in, and you know, stories about. So I've got the book around here somewhere. In fact, I think it's right here. Yeah, it is. Here's the manual. You can't see it if you're listening. Sorry about that, but pretty good size, and it breaks down the family, you know. So it would be fun to take some of this stuff and get it online where it's going to be kept, hopefully. I mean, genealogy.com will stay around forever.
I know my sister did something on Facebook, and then I started getting some, like, cousins of, you know, like some other cousins.
Yeah,
like,
that would be the logical place for it.
Who's this?
So I agree. So I agree with you that that would be a good place. The stuff that I've seen on there so far is not nearly as in depth.
Yeah.
And the other thing that that assumes is that the majority of the people in your family tree are living and on Facebook.
True.
So that's where it breaks down a little bit. But that's where I kind of feel like the future needs to meld those two together so that they can bring some social media into the ancestry creation process.
How cool would that be to have a Facebook API into ancestry.com? So you buy.
I think they have to be working on it. Yeah. You know, if they're not, they're really, really missing out. Because I think that's the way to go.
So it's share data, you know, not only into Facebook, but whatever family links and information that you have about them could flow back into ancestry.com.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I did hear a while ago there was supposed to be some kind of option where you can go into Facebook and you can actually download all your information. Wasn't there something like that? So I wonder if
if you want to get out.
Okay, if you want to get out. Yeah, because I wonder if you can download, like you said, Chris, there, some guy had some form, some database, and then he converted it and then whatever, uploaded. So I wonder if there's something that you can, like, with all, let's say, you know, yeah, you've already generated a bunch of friends and this and that on Facebook, and then you say, okay, you know, give me a file that I can somehow maybe convert and then import it into this.
And really, that would certainly be a possibility. So if you get somebody that was able to create a rich family tree add-in to Facebook, all it would take is one of those GEDCOM files, and it would take seconds to branch that all out. So
I would think that'd be fairly easy.
So yeah, without beating that too much to death, there's another kind of deeper ancestral thing that I've been playing with, which is a website called 23andMe. And this is a personal genome mapping site. So there's a company out in California that allows you to spit in a test tube. Send your spit into them, and for $100, they will map your entire SNP map. SNP is a single nucleotide polymorphism. They're the single letter differences that humans have different from each other, and they map just over 10,000 of these, which ends up, believe it or not, being the majority of the differences between the four of us and all the people on the planet.
Wow.
So you can look at those individual letters and essentially have a rough draft of your entire genome from beginning to end. From that, they then can give you carrier states for diseases. They can give you susceptibilities for different processes if they know the genetic susceptibilities. They can tell you personal traits that are most likely. So things that relate to body habitus and eye color and interesting things like that that they've correlated to the SNP map. And they can show you your ancestral origins based on your genetic haplotype. So you can look back and see where your paternal and maternal genomes have originated over the last 30, 40,000 years.
Really?
Yeah, so I was able to see that my mother's side, my mother is primarily Italian, and however, looking 30,000 years ago, they come from sort of all over Southern Europe and part of Italy. My dad's side, who my dad has always thought he's primarily from Germany and France, when we look at his genetics 30,000 years ago, they spread primarily in Northern Africa, Western Middle East, and the Mediterranean. So really surprising results from that standpoint. A lot of interesting medical correlations that come up from there. I found out I'm a disease trait carrier for a rare iron storage disorder that really should never affect me, but could potentially affect future children.
Chris, is that too much info to know? To be honest with you,
some people, yes. For me, absolutely not. Okay. I want to know every little detail, every dark secret that's locked away in my genome, and even the ones they hide. They hide the answer for Alzheimer's and Huntington's disease and breast cancer.
Really?
And you have to specifically ask to have that data revealed to you. Because some people will find out that they carry a gene for breast cancer and freak out. You know, it's going to cause them to need psychiatric counseling, I suppose.
Yeah.
For me, it's something that's a valuable tool to be able to know what I do and don't carry in my genes, where there's minefields and where there's some things that actually protect me against certain things. And maybe I shouldn't worry as much about one thing as the next person. So I think it's a fantastic tool. I think it's fun. It also allows you to collaborate with family members. So if your spouse does it, you can look at potential things that your kids should watch out for. If your other family members and cousins do it, particularly parents or other close relatives, it can further refine your haplotype map so you can see more closely where your relatives came from tens of thousands of years ago. And it's a pretty darn powerful tool. This technology is very similar to technologies that were used, 10, 15 years ago for large-scale mapping of genetic information. And it costs millions of dollars to do this. And the fact that it's come down to a single piece of silicon and metal and that they can map your entire SNP genome in about 4 weeks.
That went into mapping.
Right.
The genome and the race right. to do that.
It's slightly different. You know, before I get emails on this, it's a different technology. You know,
okay.
they weren't going base by base to figure out the exact sequence. But once they knew where the variation lied, that paved the way to be able to go back and just analyze the individual spots. But still, the fact that they can look at my genes and be able to find 10,000 or more unique letters throughout my genome from a tube full of spit is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. So humans share in our genome, most of the genes are the same.
99.999% of the nucleotides of the individual letters are the same.
Exactly.
All of the genes are the same. So we all have the same genes. It's just whether the letters are encoded the same way. And it's those variations in the encoding that make up all the differences.
Wow. And 10,000 spots.
Roughly. Well, there's a little more than that, but the ones that they have any significance and clinical significance to,
okay. Wow.
are within that realm.
That's
so.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you, how long ago did you do that?
I did that about probably a month and a half ago, and I've had the data for 2-3 weeks, and have been kind of starting my way through that and finding some very interesting information. So.
Yeah. Have you had anybody in your family do it yet?
So the guy that made his genome, his family tree that we've linked up, he got all excited about it. And so he sent his spit sample off.
Nice.
And I'll eventually see if I can get, you know, brothers and aunts and uncles and parents to try to do it as well. But for right now, I think they're probably a little creeped out by it.
Yeah. The too much information thing, I mean, John just kind of admitted he's got too many family members. He doesn't want to know where they're all at. I struggle a little bit wanting to know. I mean, I know I've got some propensity for certain diseases like diabetes and some heart right. disease and stuff, but do I really want to know that? I mean, then I've got to really change.
Well, mine's some genetically a sprinter, which I know is not true. So there's some things that are still left up to fate, I guess.
Yeah.
But there were some, I will tell you, there were a few things in there that were absolutely spot on in some very interesting ways. So things that I would never have thought were at root a genetic issue. And then I was like, oh, you know, I guess that is the cause. I have a clear genetic reason for some interesting features. And I was very surprised by some of those.
And you're not all the way through the data, I assume, then. There's more to
No, that. The, right. And the nice thing is, as they continue to research and find new information, that gets added in. So all of these points in the genome are potential research subjects. And so as people research those genes and those spots within the genome, as they make breakthroughs, that gets added. So your data, your raw data is always there and always being improved by millions of researchers, well, thousands of researchers around
yeah.
the world
yeah.
who are looking at your at the meaning of this code. We know the coding of the human genome, but by far we're still trying to figure out what all the code means and what the proteins are doing when they
right.
are coded a certain way. So.
Yeah. So in that research, Chris, and you're maybe closer to that than any of us, does 10 years make a big difference? Does 50 years make a big difference in that?
In the advancement?
Yeah.
Well, of course.
I mean, no,
so,
what
so,
I mean
oh.
is it slow research or is it really, really
no,
fast
it's,
research?
It's really, really fast. I mean, okay. we're talking within 5 years, I'm sure we more than double the data that's available on each of those points.
Wow.
And it's only going to grow faster from here.
Interesting. So. Oh, very cool. Guys, anything to add to that?
Nope. Interesting. That's it.
Go ahead.
How does it tie in with stuff like protein folding and stuff like that? Are there public computing
aspects to this?
Aspects to it as well?
So this is a very different technology. This is less useful for determining variation and more useful for analyzing how that variation relates to medical research and genomic data. The one thing that they do that's fun is they have a long series of questionnaires that help them figure out if there are things they're missing. So they say things like, do you enjoy the taste of fresh cucumber? Does your urine smell after you eat asparagus? You know, things that like seem ridiculous, but what they may find is that they get a clear distinction. If 1,000 people answer yes and no, and they realize, well, wait a minute, 500 that said that they do like cucumber all had this exact profile, and 500 that don't have this exact profile, they can look back and say, well, wait a minute, where do those differences come? Oh, they're all in the cucumber taste gene, which we didn't know that's what it was, but now we know.
So that's very much building up a matrix and a profile as to what matches with what.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Okay.
Chris, let me ask you this question, you know, being the resident doctor that in the podcast tonight. What do we need to worry about from a technology perspective? DVN brought this up in chat.
Sure.
What do we need to worry about from a HIPAA perspective of that's our personal information? It's got information that may affect things like insurance and
So a couple things there. So first off, this is not medical grade data. Okay, so this is not something where they've sequenced the same gene 10 times to validate that they have the sequence exactly right. This is not something where they've gone in and taken multiple samples to make sure that the samples are accurate. So if the question ever came up insurance wise, you know, do you have medical information stating that you are at risk for disease X? This is not medical information.
Okay.
This is for interest use only. If you found something you wanted to get tested, sure, you could go get it tested. As far as HIPAA information goes, nothing that's in there is being used with identifier tags to yourself. So if it's being used for research at all, they de-identify it completely and just use that information for comparative analysis. And the last thing is, you know, HIPAA implies that it's something that you are trying to keep to yourself and keep private, and it's medical information. This is something that I'm saying I can choose what I share and what I don't, much like on Facebook, and I can go out and say, you know what, I am comfortable with everyone knowing my gene for my hair texture. You know, that's fine.
Yeah.
I'm not all that comfortable having everyone know my genetic propensity for high cholesterol.
Right.
So you can pick some of that, and you can also pick individual people to share things with. So I can say my wife, I don't have a wife, but my wife and I can share all our information, and she can see everything about me, and I can see everything about her. But it's not a public display. So,
no, but let's say for a second, Sony is running the site,
right? And it goes down, and everyone gets access. So,
well, no, yeah, it hacks into it.
You know, so that gets into stuff like the movie Gattaca and things like that, where, you know, realistically, if someone wants my genetic data that badly, I'm pretty okay with that. You know, it doesn't really have any direct impact on me. It does have that fear factor of, you know, oh my God, what's someone going to do with that? But realistically, the fact that they know that I can smell the asparagus in my pee is not that worrisome. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, you know, those are some good points there. And I think there's some individuals who might be worried about that information being released into the wild either.
And that's your total prerogative to use it or not use it. I'm a sciencey guy that loves every bit of information I can get. And this was a no-brainer for me to sign up for the service. Yeah. So.
Well, voluntary or involuntary, you know, we got to think about, hopefully they're doing everything they can to secure that data to make sure it's not.
They claim they are.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, we would hope they would. But just, I think it's a good point. It's a good point to bring up and to mention.
Sure.
And folks want to think about that. If you don't want your data out there, if you're dead set against it, don't spit in the bottle.
That's right. You have a choice.
So that's if you're a freak about that, don't do it.
Is it a little test tube kind of thing?
It's not big. Actually, it's more spit than you'd expect. So it's actually not the easiest thing to fill. I think it's about 4 or 5 milliliters, which once you've spit 2 or 3, you're kind of dry. So
is that like the ones they use for full carrier types where it sort of looks like a contact lens cup?
It's actually a tall plastic test tube with a little kind of funnel on top in case you're not very accurate at spitting. and once you spit in there, you close it, and then you twist the funnel top thing, and it closes it down. So,
okay, we do a saliva sample, and they gave us a thing that looked like a contact lens cup, and it took us about half an hour to fill it.
My cousin that tried it said he had to spend a half an hour thinking of delicious food. So he was like trying to come up with the latest thing. And you're not allowed to eat a half hour before it so that you're not spitting burrito into your test tube sample. And you get results back saying that your mother was a faba bean.
They're like, oh, look, chimichangas.
So they definitely want a pure sample. So it's interesting.
Hey, Chris, one more question. I know you're not an insurance expert, but any idea? I mean, could we get to a point someday where insurance companies require a test like this to be run before they'll insure you?
So, you know, I could look at that both ways. So there probably would be laws that'll get passed that will prohibit that. So you could say, well, I would never want that. That'd be horrible. Well, what if you do want it? What if you realize that your genetic profile actually means that you're not likely to have one of the top 5 diseases that cost $5 million in a hospital before you die, and they say, no, you're likely to die of a sudden explosive brain aneurysm, and we won't have to pay a thing for that.
Right?
So the insurance company says, you're golden. We know you're going to kick off in the next 20 years, and we're not going to have to pay for it, so we're only going to have you pay $20 a month for your medical insurance, and we're taking that gamble because we have genetic information that says you're a pretty safe bet. And so now you sign up and say, hey, great, I'm saved because I can do this. And you could see where there could be 2 different insurance pools. There could be an insurance pool for those who are forthcoming with their genetic data and those that are not. And those that are not just go into a general pool where you do have to go like we do now and spend thousands of dollars a year because it's a crapshoot. And you don't know who's going to need that $1 million worth of medical care this year and who's not. But if you come from a family where you say, you know what, yeah, we really don't get any of this stuff, maybe that's not where you need to spend your money. Maybe you need to spend it on, you know, living your life for the next 10 years before your brain explodes.
Yeah.
So that's a horrible way to put it, but
it's a good point. So. That's why you're the best doctor in podcasting.
Talking about brains exploding.
No, that's a very good point that it could work the other way too and work like safe driver discounts for your auto insurance or smoke detectors.
So you can see that guy for like Allstate, you know, like, is your genome compatible with lower rates? Sign up now for a discount.
I'd just love to see an insurance company give a discount.
Well, they say they do, but who knows?
Yeah, well, there's Rich is pinging me, and there is a very interesting debate around this, I think.
Sure.
That goes way beyond what we do from a home tech podcast perspective.
So 23andme.com, the number 23andme.com, and ancestry.com are the 2 places to go play.
Yeah, very good. Well, Chris, thanks for bringing that to us tonight, and thanks for spending some time on the podcast. It's always good to have you in here, and we'll try and get you scheduled for another month or two out, and
love
doing
that
again. And I appreciate you doing that, John. Had great to have you filling in for Christian tonight. We didn't do Christian's Corner, and Christian actually has a version 2 of Christian's Corner coming out. If you listened to the music last week and heard him singing, actually Christian's singing debut was here last week on the Home Tech Podcast. So if you missed that, go back and listen to it. But John, thanks for coming out tonight.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's always good to have you. And of course, you can listen to John and I and Dave McCabe each week over at homeservershow.com as we talk about storage and home servers. Andrew, great to have you out this evening this afternoon for you, right? It's just noon there.
Yeah, it's just about noon, yep.
Lunchtime for you. Great to have you out there and great to have you each week as part of the podcast and doing the show notes as well. I'll remind folks that if they want to converse with us about issues on the podcast, have some ideas about what you'd like us to talk about, you can send us an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Or if you just got a comment, you can make it on the post on the website, theaverageguy.tv. We do have two other podcasts that we do out there, both fitness and financial tech. Pretty self-explanatory what we talk about. On those programs, you can go out there to The Average Guy and have a listen of those. You can also find us on Facebook just by searching for The Average Guy Network. Gentlemen, thanks again this week, and we'll do it all again here next Thursday. Some live stuff. I'll remind some folks we're going to try and get this podcast out quick tonight for folks to listen to. If you're listening to this on Friday or Saturday, Home Server Show Meetup in Madison, Wisconsin, or really Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin on Saturday. We're going to try and do a home tech podcast live from that show 3 or 4 o'clock central. So be watching Ustream and my tweets at Jay Collison for that. We may try and get it, bring a bunch of guys in and just do this general free for all home tech podcast
mashup.
Yeah, it'll be fun. We'll just bring everybody who's available in. And of course, John, you'll be there virtually through Skype for us for the whole day.
Sure.
That'll be good to have you out. So, guys, have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here on the Home Tech Podcast next week. Good night.
Bye.
Well, didn't England send all of their criminals to Australia back then? Am I being an ignorant Hoosier? I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, penal colony, you know, we're a bunch of convicts.